Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. This week, I've got some assigned reading for you. You need to check out the book Saving Lives, Saving Memories by our guest today, Jim Sanders. You can find out all the information about that on our website, kmjnow.com. His website for the book, www.ambulancedriver.com. We'll hear all about his journey from Modesto to the Battle of the Bulge, all across Europe to the Buchenwald concentration camp, where he's been back a couple times. But let's start early on, Jim. You're 86 years old now. So you were a teenager growing up in the Central Valley in the 1940s. Your family had been here for a while. In fact, this home that we're sitting in is over 100 years old. Did you have any sense that your world was about to change in 1941?
Of course, we had no idea. Had no idea at all. Pearl Harbor came along, and we didn't really know where Pearl Harbor was, you know.
I guess that was your senior year at Ceres High School, which I've got to withhold my high school rivalries here. We had some vicious baseball games between Los Banos and Ceres when I was in high school. But now I call games for the Bulldogs. So you were a Bulldog at Ceres High. And December 7th, 1941, you're probably just looking forward to Christmas vacation. What do you remember about that day?
Well, it's very clear still. It's interesting that it's clear. I was riding my bike down to a neighbor's. We had a ranch down on Moffett Road south of Ceres. My dad had a ranch. And I was riding my bike to our neighbors to go hunting with the boys, rabbit hunting. And I went in the house, and their father was listening to a program. And it came on that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. So he said to me, "Jim, you go home right now and tell your parents that a place called Pearl Harbor has been bombed." And so I hopped on the bike and went home, and my folks had a little small radio, and they didn't have it on, so they turned it on, and then we got out the Atlas to find out exactly where Pearl Harbor was. So that was a day that I really do remember, yes.
And did you have a sense at that point that it was going to change your life, that maybe things were going to be different for you personally?
Well, yes, of course, we thought, you know, we were the right age, and probably it takes young men to fight wars, so that we were going to be involved, but we didn't know how, but it would be revealed later.
Walk me through how it was revealed. I understand you had a desire, like so many young Americans did at that point, to maybe get into the Air Corps and be a pilot and fly as part of this war, but as it turned out, that's not what happened for you.
No, I tried to get in, but I didn't have the 20/20 eyes that you needed. I had one eye 20/20, and the other eye was 20/40, so I just waited my turn. And when I turned 18 on January 4th, 1943, I was sent into the military.
Now, once they took you, and you're 18, you're in the Army now, did you have an idea of what you might do in the Army, what you wanted to do, or are you just waiting to see what they wanted you to do?
Had no idea what we'd do. We went over to Monterey, to the Presidio, and we're given our uniforms. We were there about a week, and then they posted the signs of where you were going to go and what you were going to be in, and it just so happened that I was going to be sent to Camp Carson, Colorado, to be in the medical corps. And, of course, we all wanted to be tank drivers or something. But in the end, I was happy to be in the ambulance. It was the only vehicle that had a heater, and we could sleep in it at night. And we had our own set of blankets, and so it was great.
What was it like with the other young men that you were training with, that you're getting ready to go over and fight this war that you don't know how long it's going to last? You have no idea what you're in for. How would you describe the atmosphere with you and your fellow young Army guys?
We were all in the same boat, and none of us knew what was going to happen. And Monterey was just a revelation. I tell in the book some of these stories, and you'll have to read the book to see. But Monterey, we get to Monterey, and the first day, a big sergeant is up on a stand, on a platform, and he's going to explain short arm inspection to us. We had no idea what a short arm inspection was. And So he finally revealed it to us, and we were all looked at each other and said, oh, my God.
Now, I got to ask you, as a farm boy, as someone growing up, you know, in a farming community, in a farming family, and your original family farm is right where Modesto Junior College is now, do you think that that toughened you up and prepared you for some of that training that the military would give you?
Well, of course, my dad had a ranch down between Ceres and Turlock, and it was a dairy, a small dairy, and he'd raise beans for a cash crop and then alfalfa to feed the animals. But in the summertime, they let me come up to my grandfather's place to work in the fruit. So we worked in the fruit harvest, and I got old enough to take care of the cutting shed because they cut the fruit at that. Apricots that couldn't go to a cannery were cut and made dried fruit out of. So we got a good workout. We got a good workout. And then every night we'd take the old orchard truck and go up and go swimming in the canals, you know. That was a big deal. So we enjoyed our time learning to work. And, of course, we had to work from the beginning. We never knew anything else. When I came home from the war, I knew we had to work. I never went on unemployment. I just got a job. I worked. Went back to work for Union Oil Company first, yeah.
And I know you're still very active. In fact, you still spend some time in the skies because you eventually did learn how to fly a plane. Not in the military, but after that. So let's talk about heading overseas. I know we're fast-forwarding a little bit, and if people want to fill in all the blanks, they can get that book. Saving Lives, Saving Memories is the book. You can find out the information on our website, kmjnow.com. Walk me through heading overseas, knowing that you're going across for a purpose, that some challenges lay ahead. How did you kind of wrap your mind around that and prepare yourself for what you thought might be happening?
We just looked forward each day to see what new challenge we had. That's all we could do. We just were all in the same boat, and so we all became good friends. I had a group of people. I was on ambulance number 33, so we were good friends with all the ambulances in our platoon, and we all talked together, and we all lived together. So, yes, and the ride on Queen Mary was a new experience for all of us, and she traveled by herself because she was faster than the submarines could do. And so we made it over in 6 days to Glasgow Harbor. And Glenock, Scotland is where we offloaded, yeah.
I haven't researched the population of Ceres at that time, but I imagine there are more people on the Queen Mary than in Ceres.
Exactly. I think Ceres was about 2,000, and there was about 15,000 troops aboard in the Queen Mary on this trip. Yeah. So we slept down in actually, they'd taken the lower swimming pool and covered it over so that they put their ship's treasures down in the pool, and then they had boards over the top of the pool, and then they put bunks around, and halfway up, they made a mess hall. So, and it was rough seas on the way over, and the food would slide off the tables and down the wall. And so some of the guys never got up from their bunks the whole trip. They were sick. I made it all right without being sick, but we didn't eat too much. Actually, there was a kitchen just down a little ways from us. We were almost down to waterline, and they were selling us roast beef sandwiches, nice big roast beef sandwiches for 50 cents a piece. And, you know, 50 cents when we're only making $50 a month was a lot, but we ate mostly roast beef sandwiches rather than to go up and eat kidney stew.
Well, and I'm sure a few months after that, you would have died for any of that food that you could have gotten on the Queen Mary. And I imagine if the seas were that rough, you were pretty happy to find some land after 6 days.
Yeah, the green landscape of Scotland and Ireland looked great to us. In fact, the guys that had been ill for the whole trip got up and looked out and saw the green, it was smooth water by that time, and they all got well all of a sudden.
Well, and of course, Eisenhower and all the generals knew that there would be something going on in June of 1944, but how much of an indication did you guys have of what the timeline looked for you and when you'd actually be heading further over?
We had no idea, of course. We went to a little town called Hay. It was on the Wye River on the border of England and Wales. And it was just a small town, but they had three pubs, I believe, and a cinema, and a tea and tart shop, and a fish and chip shop. And with all the troops there, up on the hill, we were up on a hill that was supposedly was Oliver Cromwell's, one of his estates. And we were in bunkhouses and Quonset huts out on the fields, and the officers, of course, stayed in the big house. If we get a pass into town, the tea and tart shop lasted about an hour, and the fish and chips shop never had any fish. But we'd go to the cinema and we'd have a good time, or we'd go to a pub. And at that time, the pubs were beautiful. They were painted and clean, and people would come in the evening and discuss what was happening in the war, and then they'd play darts or shuffleboard or do something and have a pint or whatever they had at night. And it was a friendly place. And I took my wife back 50 years later, and I knew when we came over down the hill it was going to be different, because there were television antennas up all over. And we went to the pubs, and they were dark and dreary, and two old men sitting in the corner.
Yeah, a half century can change a lot of things. And getting back to 1944 here, you're a 19-year-old kid, and this seems like a pretty good adventure so far, but I guess that was all about to change.
Yes, it was. On D-Day, we were actually on our way down to the coast, south coast of England, getting ready to depart to Normandy. But because they didn't break out of Normandy for at least a month and a half, they were late. Patton always blamed Montgomery because he couldn't break out. But so we didn't actually cross until somewhere the first part of July. So we were there for the breakout when they broke out of Normandy. We were with the 4th Armored Division when they broke out on August 1st.
Tell me about your first taste of combat, because as an ambulance driver, I think people can infer that it doesn't get hot and heavy for you until there's something going on in terms of shots being fired, artillery being leveled at each other. What was your first inclination? This is real. This is war. This is going to be rough.
Yes, we, of course, we'd hauled casualties before. In England, we'd hauled them that had come back from D-Day. And we also, when we were in Normandy for a while before the breakout, we would haul casualties, but not any actual battle casualties. Well, on the 1st of August, we finally connected up with the medical group that we were supposed to be with the 4th Armored Division and the battalion surgeon that was there. And it was in a big field. Was, of course, by then it was August 1st, so the grass was green and the trees were all leafed out and the hedgerows clear around this field. And we pulled into this field, and here was all these wounded, because the 4th Armored, it was the first time they'd been in action. And the Germans had 88-millimeter guns around the city of Rennes, R-E-N-N-E-S. And they just, they were anti-aircraft. But all they do with an 88 gun is to lower it down, and it makes a beautiful anti-tank gun. And they really got clobbered. And so this field was just full of wounded. And I can still see in my mind, it's amazing what the brain does. I can still see the first load that we picked up. There were 4 litters, and we put, of course, 2 on the top and 2 down on the bottom on the floor. And the man down, I can still see him, down on the right-hand side. His head was completely wound up in bandages and completely bloody. And before we closed the doors, a medical officer came by and he said, "Pull him out, he's dead." Well, that was our initiation. So we took him out, put him aside, and put someone else in. And we hauled out of that field for 2 nights and 2 days back up into Normandy to an evac hospital up there.
So nonstop, driving one way and the other, dropping off wounded soldiers, picking some more up. And this isn't unopposed driving, I'm sure, either. There's still shots being fired and artillery flying, right?
Oh, yeah. There was artillery. But out of the 30 ambulances we had in the company, we lost only 8. And we had a number of people wounded, but no one killed. So, but on that trip back up from where we were up into Normandy, we never drove with lights at night. So we just had the little cat eyes, identification cat eyes on the front bumper, on the front fender. And so we drove by the tops of the trees because it was lighter up there. And I know on several trips back, there was dead people along the way, of course. And there was one German on this corner. he just kept getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and finally I couldn't even look at him when we came back by. Nobody stopped to pull him off the road.
One of the natural questions that I think occurs to people listening is, had you run into any opposition, what could have you done? Did you have any way to defend yourselves, or you just have to rely on their goodwill?
We had to rely on the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Convention stated that we medics would not carry guns, and we'd be identified with the big red crosses on the ambulance. And in my book, I have pictures of the ambulances, and I have a good color picture on front of our ambulance. And the people that did get hit were actually in the wrong place at the wrong time. I only saw one deliberate aim at medical ambulances. There was a group of ambulances. We were up on a hill, and we were watching our group of ambulances on a road down below. And a Messerschmitt fighter plane came over, and he made a pass. And it was, fine. He made another pass. He didn't do anything. But I guess it was too big a temptation. He just finally went back and gave it one blip. And there was an ambulance with a lieutenant just behind the assistant driver. Got hit in the head by the 20-millimeter shell, and he had battle fatigue, actually. Well, he had no more battle fatigue after that. And we went down, took a look at the ambulance, and the blood was running out on the running board, and it was a big mess. The two drivers each got the Purple Heart because they got a piece of shrapnel in them from the shell. But that's the only time that I saw a deliberate action on an ambulance.
Well, and I imagine that has to do something in your brain, too, and tell you, well, if it can happen to those guys, maybe I'm next.
A funny thing about that, you never think it's going to be you that's going to be hit. You never do. It's always going to be somebody else. And it never enters your mind, hey, this could be me, you know. You just don't think that way. I don't know why, but that's the way it was.
Well, maybe that's a piece of why you survived and why you're still going strong at 86 years old. Jim Sanders of Modesto, California, our guest today. His book, Saving Lives, Saving Memories. You can check that out on our website, kmjnow.com. And we'll be back with more of his story from the Battle of the Bulge to Buchenwald and beyond. It's Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Jim Sanders of Modesto, California. He's 86 years young, and he has a book. In fact, the one who helped him write that book, Martha Leffler. I'm not related to her, but she must be a great lady to have put together this book with you.
She's 90 years old. I had 8 hours of tape to begin with. And this gal that was going to do it said no, she couldn't do it. So I knew Martha. I knew she wrote books, and she had books actually that are marketed now. And so I called her, and she said, yes, Jim. She said, I knew her before. And she said, I'm looking for another project. But she said, you know, I'm going to be 89, and you're going to be 85. We got to get with it. So I had all this 8 hours of tape. She didn't want that. She wanted it all transcribed. We had to just transcribe that whole thing, and it took us, oh my gosh, that was really a job. But we finally got it done, and she did a beautiful job, I think, in the book. And she made it sound just like me. She's a writer that can take your words and make it sound like you, and everybody that reads my book tells me that it sounds just like me. I originally wrote it, you know, as most veterans, we came back, we forgot about it. It just happened to us, but we wanted to go on with our lives. And it wasn't until maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, that I read a book by Dr. Brendan Phibbs, who came home. He'd been a battalion surgeon. He came home and he became a heart specialist, and he wrote books on the heart. And in fact, you can go on, the computer and type in Brendan Phibbs, and it shows all the books he's written. And along with that is a book he wrote about his experiences as a battalion surgeon in World War II, and it's called The Other Side of Time. And I read it, and there was parts of it that I liked so well that I called him. He lived in Tucson, and this was a number of years ago, and we sort of bonded because He was a man that we would pick up the wounded from to take back to the VAC hospitals. Although we were with someone in the 4th Armored, and he was, I think, with the 11th Armored. But he said to me then, he said, Jim, you should write your memories. And I said, well, I could never write a book like yours, Doctor. And he said, well, you have a lot of memories. I know you guys that carried the casualties back from the front back to the VAC hospitals had a lot of experiences. I said, yeah, we did. And then that started me thinking about it. So I thought, well, I'll write it for our children, our grandchildren, my siblings, and my friends, and we'll see what happens. And so I happened to get Martha to write it, and then I got a graphic artist named Mark Haskett, and he's also the publisher and the copy editor. And then when we finished it, we thought it was a good book, and people, all my family, thought it was a good book. So we decided, well, I'll go ahead and publish it, and we'll see what happens. And so I moved. The first group was about 1,000 books, nobody thought I'd move those, but I got rid of those. Now I'm working on 1,300 now. If I can get the website out, people will like this book.
Well, we're going to keep doing that for you, and we've got that website, www.ambulancedriver.com, linked at our website, kmjnow.com. The book is called Saving Lives, Saving Memories, A 19-Year-Old Ambulance Driver in the Wake of Patton's Army. That's what Jim Sanders was in 1944. He would turn 20 in 1945 and has some pretty intriguing stories from that year as well. Let's pick up your story where we left off. You talked about getting across to Normandy, there for the breakout. You told us about your first taste of combat, and you talked about seeing these patients and having that first jolt of having a dead patient taken off your ambulance and one that had a chance to survive being put on there. And I imagine with all these patients that you saw, some of those stick in your mind. What kinds of things did you see, maybe that scarred you, maybe that inspired you, things that stick with you till still today?
Well, I still feel today that we did a good job, that we did something that was worthwhile. We were helping take care of these wounded guys. And, of course, we had to take care of them from the battalion aid station back to the back hospitals. And at night, sometimes it would take 3 or 4 hours, depending how fast the front was moving. If the front was moving slowly, then the back hospitals were able to move up closer. But if it was a fast-moving front, like when we crossed France, we'd have to go 200 or 300 miles. It'd take a long time. And, of course, we had no urinals or bedpans, so we'd take the liners out of our helmets, and we'd use that for all the functions that had to be done. And, of course, there would be some vomiting, and then we'd have to change plasma bottles and just basic medical stuff. But I felt like that we were really doing something to contribute, you know. I can see how medical people must feel, that they are really doing a job.
I'm curious, too, with all those interactions, and in some situations you're nonstop ferrying wounded soldiers back and forth, did you allow yourself to get to know any of these guys? Or did you try to avoid developing any kind of relationship because you knew there's probably a good chance they weren't going to make it?
Well, that was difficult for us to know, of course. But no, we didn't really, because we had so many. It was just too much to. In fact, as I told you, in the field, that first field, we thought, well, on the first load, we're going to start keeping track of it. We'll keep track of how many patients were carried. Well, after the first 2 days in ice, we just gave up on that. It was impossible to keep track of how many were in the ambulance. So we had to keep it clean. And we carried 4 litters and 14 blankets. And so there was always an exchange. If we left 2 litters, we'd pick up 2 litters at the VAC hospital. If they used 5 blankets, then we'd pick up 5 blankets. So we always had the same amount of equipment on board. And we had to take care of the ambulance, keep it, you know, clean as possible, and mopped out every once in a while.
Did you ever feel pressure, knowing that you were responsible for the lives of these men who were in pretty treacherous ground already, having been wounded?
Not real pressure. We just wanted to do our job. We wanted to get them back to where they could get more medical help. That's all we could do.
a lot of guys doing their jobs for a long time during World War II. And as you made your way across France before you ended up at the Battle of the Bulge at the end of 1944, anything that stands out during those 5 or 6, I guess about 5 months between that and the Battle of the Bulge?
Lots of things happen. And Paul, we would run into the night if I started to tell you all the stories, and it's not possible to do. I can remember when we came across Chartres. We saw Chartres Cathedral in the city of Chartres, and we saw these two huge spires going up into the sky from, we were coming from the west to the east, and what was that? And so we got there and we found out it was Chartres Cathedral. Well, then we understood more about religion and about what the poor peasants did, because they built that cathedral, and they could go out of their little hovel in the morning, their little what it was, and they could see those spires going up to heaven. And so that gave them courage to go on for the day, I guess. Whenever you saw those tall church spires, you knew that they'd built it, and they were looking up to better life. But I don't know whatever ever happened to them. But anyway, we got to Paris. We bypassed Paris because they let the French Second Armored go in first, you know, and then some of our military got to go in. But about 3 days after, as we were going on east toward Verdun and Metz, some passes were drawn to go back to Paris. And I happened to draw one in the company. There were 3 of us from the company who got to go back to Paris. And of course, it was just after liberation. It was unbelievable. People dancing and singing down the streets, and everybody had a bottle of champagne or a bottle of wine or something. And I was walking down the Champs-Élysées, and another guy coming toward me was a guy from Ceres High School. And we walked by each other, and then we turned around and thought, hey, I know you. And so we went in and had a couple glasses of wine and talked about things, and then we went on our way. But I spent a day and a night there, and the stories are in the book about what we did there. We kept going and went to Verdun, and it was the interesting part around Verdun was seeing the area of World War I, where so many thousands and thousands of men were killed. And we took a look at some of the old forts that were still there. And actually, you see, in 1918 to 1944, that wasn't that long ago. And the old trenches were still there with the barbed wire, and then you could see helmets and that kind of stuff. So, and huge rows of cemeteries, and it was just unbelievable that many people could be thrown into battle and killed. And one of the things, we came across a cemetery, I think it might have been St. Mihiel, and what they were doing, this impressed me, and I never forgot it, and it's in the book. What they were doing, they took down the fence and just had a trencher dig a trench to include guys from, you know, that you had to bury from the graves. We traveled with graves registration, so they would take them back to some place where they could be buried. And to think that, what, these few 20 years later, here they were burying more guys. It was incredible that they could let that thing happen. But it's young men that fight the war and old men that start them. So that's what happens.
Well, and you were one of the young men who got to come home from the war, not one of the more than 400,000 Americans who gave their lives. And I know you've got a good story about how you brought that home for your family years after the war. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Tell me about the Battle of the Bulge, because a lot of people have heard about it. A lot of people know it was cold. A lot of people know it was huge, that there were a lot of casualties. But how did you experience it as an ambulance driver?
We were near Metz, France. We were east of Metz, France, at a little town called Boulay. We were carrying casualties back. I believe we were actually with the 5th Infantry Division at that time, from this town called Boulay, which is about 30 miles east of Metz, back to Metz, France. I tell in the book that was the only time we got in an accident. I saw these cat eyes coming, and I kept moving over to the right toward the trees, and I thought I was going to hit the trees, and all of a sudden this Jeep hit us on the right front fender and took the wheel off and went on back behind us somewhere. And of course it was all dark, And I tell about it in the book. And the man up on the left side, on the litter on the top, his leg was in a splint, and it jumped out of the splint. So he was screaming. And we had four walking wounded. So we got his leg back in the splint, and then we went back to see about the Jeep. We didn't know whether it was a Jeep. It was a Jeep. It was upside down on top of two guys. So we got the walking wounded to go back and help us, and we lifted it up and pulled the two guys out from underneath the Jeep. And one of them's head took every compress we had in the ambulance to try to stop the blood. So then, as an empty ambulance had come back, going back toward Boulay, we loaded our casualties on, and they took them back. And then the next one took the two guys. And we found out later that there had been five guys in an infantry outfit that had gone back and got drunk and Mets and were going back to the front. And it threw three of them out, and they just took off, left their buddies there. Boy, great buddies. Anyway, the bulge came along in December. And so Patton told him he could get up there in, I don't know what, was 64, 46 hours or something. And it was the first time we drove with headlights. We drove from Metz up into Belgium with our headlights on, up actually into Luxembourg first. And then we were attached again to the 4th Armored. And we happened to be with the group that went into Bastogne. What I remember is how happy we were to be in the ambulance, because the infantry guys were out here walking along beside us in the snow and mud. And we were sitting in there behind the heater, and we knew then that we'd happened to get in the right place. Yeah, it was bad for them, and we carried a number of casualties back from that action. And then, of course, we went on into Germany after that. In January, we crossed into Germany. And then a dash to the Rhine River, and we crossed the Rhine River at Oppenheim, south of Darmstadt, below Frankfurt. And we crossed the Rhine, and I remember the night we crossed the Rhine. We sat all afternoon back on the west side while they were doing the bridge across, and the 5th Infantry had gone across in boats, secured the bridgehead on the other side, and then the engineers set up the bridge for the rest of the troops to go across, and the 4th Armored to cross, and we were always at the end of the column. We traveled with a column, combat command B, and we'd be the last troops. But they'd sat there all afternoon and waiting, and somebody had picked up schnapps along the way, and so we had enough drivers left to drive, and so I drove one ambulance and Lockhart drove another one. And I remember we didn't get across the bridge till nighttime, and there was a lot of firing going on, and some German planes trying to bomb the bridge. And I remember they hit one right over the bridge, and he got all on fire, and he went right into the Rhine, just down a ways from us. So, you know, you never know what's going to happen. We got across the other side, and we hit the Autobahn, and we turned to the south. And that was an interesting time. I tell about it in the book. The Autobahn, of course, was open, except there were bridges that would cross it. So there was a tank up on the other side of one of these crossovers. And there was vehicles on fire in the meridian, German trucks and vehicles. And so it was lit up pretty well. And all of a sudden, people started shooting. People that had guns started shooting. And what are they shooting at? All of a sudden, a motorcycle with a sidecar came zipping along. And they were all shooting at him. But nobody hit him till he got down and he crossed under the bridge, and a tank on the other side got him. But I was hoping they might make it. Interesting enough, the armored division usually circles the wagons at night, you know, and to keep from being bypassed something. But that night they wanted to extend the bridgehead. So they kept moving all night, and we'd go through these towns that'd be on fire, and we kept going until almost morning, and we pulled into a field. They thought we better dig a foxhole, so we started digging, and we did. We started taking some shell fire from behind us, so it didn't take long for the 4th Armored to run back and take care of the artillery. So those are exciting times. And then from then on, we went on up to Frankfurt on the Main, and then followed the Autobahn on up through Hirschfeld and Gotha, G-O-T-H-A. And we stopped at Gotha, and that's somebody ordered us to go down to this little town called Ohrdruf.
Well, and I know what was waiting for you there. We need to catch another commercial break, but we will get to what you discovered at that town. And I've got a couple more questions for Jim Sanders. You've heard him refer a couple times to his book. It's called Saving Lives, Saving Memories, a 19-year-old ambulance driver in the wake of Patton's Army. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes today. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usually, the time goes by very fast when we're talking about such intriguing times as we do each week when we visit with World War II veterans. Jim Sanders, our guest today, his book, Saving Lives, Saving Memories. You can read all about it online at kmjnow.com. You can order it. We've got links to his website. It's also on Amazon. And the front cover has a picture of him in front of the ambulance that he drove as part of the 585th Ambulance Company, attached mostly to the 4th Armored Division. You make reference in that subtitle of the book, Jim, you talk about Patton's Army. And Patton was a figure that everybody seemed to have an opinion about. Would you care to share your opinion of old Blood and Guts?
I really had no opinion. I only saw him once or twice. When we got to Gotha, someone ordered us to go down to this camp, one of the sub-camps of Buchenwald called Ohrdruf. Well, no one had told us about the concentration camp. We had no idea. So we drove down about 30 miles to this little town of Ohrdruf, you know, to find out, and they sort of, everybody knew where the camp was by then. And so we went up the hill through the gate with the big deal over the gate. And
a big swastika?
Yeah, we pulled in, and all we saw were dead people. I mean, we'd seen dead and dying people, but these people, they were trying to get rid of. They were trying to burn the evidence, and they couldn't get it done. The ones that could still walk, they'd started to move them back to Buchenwald, walking. That day, that particular day, I don't know why, but we were there when Patton, Eisenhower, and Bradley drove, and Walton Walker, who was 20th Corps commander, drove in their jeeps to see the place. And that was the day that Patton had the mayor and the people in town come up to see this place. And, of course, they all knew it, but there wasn't anything they could do about it. And the mayor and his wife went home that day and committed suicide. And last year, I met the mayor, present mayor, and his wife of Ohrdruf when we were back there. And they're still trying to outlive that stigma of having the camp up on their hill of their town. And I don't know, until all of us are gone, they're not going to get away from it.
Maybe they shouldn't either, because this is an important piece of history that needs to be remembered. In a couple weeks, at the start of May, Jim is going to be up at the state capitol in Sacramento. One of the terrific things that our state legislature has done in California over recent years is honor Holocaust survivors, as well as people who had a hand in liberating some of those concentration camps. And this year, Jim is going to be honored as part of that ceremony. So stay tuned to the news in early May about that. When you talk about what you saw, and you mentioned the generals coming there and calling in the townspeople because they wanted to make sure that this wasn't glossed over in history, that it would be recorded, that there was evidence of it, that no one could explain it away, as some still try to do, amazingly enough, in parts of the world. Tell us about what you saw and what specifically struck you. I know it's not a pleasant thing to think about, but what was the most jarring thing for you to witness there?
You know, Martha Leffler, who... no relation to you, but she's Jewish, of course, and she wanted more from us. She wanted more from Ray and I about what we talked about. But it was so mind-boggling. What could we? I've talked to Ray. I said, "What did we?" He said, "I can't remember that we talked about much of anything." And you know, it was just too much. Our vocabulary wouldn't cover it. You know, it was too much. And our only involvement in this, the whole thing from Buchenwald and Ohrdruf, was that we were with the ambulance and someone, we don't remember who, ordered us to pick up people that were lying in the fields. They couldn't, we assume, and we talked about it, we think they were the people that were moving from Ohrdruf back to the camp. Now, Ohrdruf was only one of the sub-camps. There were about 80 sub-camps around Buchenwald where they went to work. Now, Buchenwald itself was not a killing camp per se. It was not a gas camp. They died. Thousands died, but they, malnutrition, beatings, whatever. But they were asked us to pick up people that were lying in the fields. And we didn't know what they were. They were in little striped pajamas with little patches, and we could put two on a litter. Can you imagine that? One's head up here, one's head down there. And we carried DDT in cans at that time. DDT, which has been banned, but they're using it again down in Africa. The malaria is worse than the DDT. We'd sprinkle DDT all over them. They're worried about typhus, and we'd sprinkle it on ourselves and all over the ambulance. And so I'm 86 and still here, so the DDT didn't get me. But anyway, we made two or three loads, and then we went on to finish the war. And we kept going, and that's about the time we heard that President Roosevelt had died. So we were in a field somewhere, and Half Track had a radio and announced that President. We didn't carry radios. So we went on to finish the war then.
I need to ask, when you look back on that, and I know that you, even in this past year, you were back at Buchenwald for the 65th anniversary of the liberation. You've taken your family back to some of these places. When you think about what happened there, the way that human beings were treated there, why, in your mind, is it important to preserve that history and to remind people of what happened there? Why do you go back for an anniversary there? Why is that important to you?
You know, it is interesting because we thought that that was going to all end, but it didn't. Mankind cannot seem to get along on this beautiful spaceship we have. They can't take care of it. When mankind came out of the cave and he saw somebody else and he picked up a rock, he threw it at him. And every piece of equipment that he ever designed to hurt someone or kill someone, he's used. And we used the big bomb in 1945, and somebody will use it again. I'm just real worried about that. Those Germans are still trying to live down this thing of the Holocaust. They're still trying to live it down all these years later. And the only time they'll be able to get rid of it is when we're all gone. And we're leaving at the rate, veterans of World War II are leaving at the rate of 2,000 a day now. So, you know, we'd have not much. If you don't believe that, just take a look at your local paper, and you'll see that World War II, three or four, are dying every day in your local paper. Think about all the local papers around the United States.
You're preaching to the choir, because that's why this show is here, to preserve these stories, and that's what your book has done, to preserve some of these stories so it won't be forgotten. You've had the chance to go back and take your children and grandchildren, and I understand that you visited a cemetery at Normandy, pointed out a certain grave to them, and had a certain message to share with them. Tell me about that.
Yes, we knew a lady in Turlock whose brother was there. I think he was maybe 20, and so they have a quite good registry there at the cemetery above Omaha Beach, and so we went, found his grave, and they were all standing around it, and I said, "Now, you see this young man, you know, that could have been me, and that would mean that you wouldn't be here. Wouldn't have had 4 days in Paris and 4 days out in this nice countryside." So, yeah, I think that they'll remember that. And part of the reason I wrote the book was because of the Holocaust deniers, too. As long as I'm alive, these eyes still remember it. It's still up here in the computer, this brain called a computer. It's still there. I can still see it today.
And I know it's going to be a very moving experience for you at the state capitol, because there will be some Holocaust survivors there, too, who are going to thank you, who are going to cry, who are going to share with you how much it means that you and so many other Americans were there. Whether you felt like you did anything special or not, you were there when they needed you. When you look back on all of it, Jim, and I know there's much more in your book, and hopefully people listening will go online, kmjnow.com. You can link to his website, www.ambulancedriver.com, and order that book. When you look back, Jim, is there anything that you're most thankful for, that when you look back, you feel like there was something that was key to your survival, or you're making it through, something that you're most proud of with the whole experience?
I'm most proud that we won that war. I've had people tell me in France, young people tell me, You know, we stopped in a shop one time in France, and a young man was running the shop, and I wanted to pay for something, some little item. He said, "No, sir, I won't take your money." He said, "If you hadn't come, we'd be speaking German now." So that is a real indication. You can't really blame the Germans today. I mean, I got to tell you one quick story here. One night we were carrying an SS major back. Now, we could carry the German wounded back as well as the American wounded, but we had to carry all American wounded back before we would carry Germans. But this one night, we had one, a German SS officer. He was wounded. Lockhart said, "Keep your helmet ready." I said, "He's not going to do anything. He's wounded." But he spoke perfect English. He said, and he got to talking to us, and he said, "You boys just want to go home after this war." I said, "Yeah, that's right. We do. We want to go home. We don't want to be here." And he said, "I want to tell you something. Within 4 years, the Americans and Germans will be allies against the Russians." And I'll never forget that. And he was so right. And we had no idea that he was correct. We said, "Oh, no, the Russians are our allies. You know, there's no way." But definitely turned out to be true.
Absolutely. And we're running out of time. But I know there's another interesting twist in your visiting back to Buchenwald and being part of these reunions, meeting other soldiers who were there at the liberation of these concentration camps, that you've met someone else who you've shared your book with. And he has a pretty interesting connection to our current leader of the United States. Tell me how that works out.
This man I met, his name is Charles Payne. And I was talking to him, and he said he was in 89th Division as they came through, and he was a PFC. And he was rode in a Jeep as he came through. And I said, "Well, I was an ambulance driver here, and I was a PFC. We were all PFCs, ambulance drivers." And I said, "Charles Payne, now I've heard that name." He said, "Yeah." He said, he was rather shy about it, but he said, "Obama was his uncle. Obama was his nephew. He was the great uncle, and his sister was the grandmother that took care of Obama." So I mailed him two books. I sent one to Charles, and I made the other one out to President Obama, and I told Charles, I said, "Now, when you see your nephew, give him this book. He'll learn something about World War II. I don't know whether he ever got it. Charles got the book. You know. I talked to Charles later, and he said, "I liked your book, but I haven't seen my nephew yet."
Well, who knows? On one of those long flights on Air Force One, he might just be flipping the same pages that you can flip at home. Jim Sanders has been our guest today. Jim, thanks so much for serving our country, for keeping some of these memories alive, and for telling us a little bit about it.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad that you're continuing to do this, because it won't be long till we'll all be gone, and it'll be just like World War One. We'll fade into the past. We'll be old soldiers, you know. We're gone.
Well, if we can do anything about that, we'll try to avoid that. This has been Hometown Heroes this afternoon. Jim Sanders, our guest. You can read more about him online at kmjnow.com. And don't forget to get his book. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.